Hey, deserving listeners, the trial. Let's watch.
It was an impossibility. So what do? You accept her vernacular. You accept what the word that she uses. And then you use that word to placate her so that it would at least calm part of the aggression. It would lessen the attacks. So explaining the monster was for me, I mean, she had told me many times that the monster was only me when I was using drugs and alcohol.
Okay, well, one, if he was using and was using opiates and or drinking, or I guess particularly drinking, he might exhibit aggression and hostility that he never would otherwise. So going down that road, that could be that he doesn't remember or wants to minimize that he actually was aggressive and hostile in an unfair way, maybe even abusive, while he was drunk. Or he would actually assert himself more when he was drunk. So I don't know, but victims who are ongoing victims of abuse might, when they're intoxicated on alcohol in particular, actually let out all of their anger that they've been stuffing the whole time because they no longer feel afraid because they're uninhibited because of the alcohol intoxication. Or their executive function is compromised such that they aren't conceiving of the consequences of actually speaking their mind. The other possibility is what I was talking about earlier, is that for Amber, who knows, but I could see this happening for someone with borderline, is they are, you know, in light of what I was saying earlier, the black and white thinking, good breast, bad breast, if you will, Melanie Klein, her words, that when you're in love with someone and it's idealization, it's like, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you're wonderful. I'm starting to see this other side of my partner that I don't like. I can't really hold that all together in one person, so I have to compartmentalize it. What could I blame? Remember I said earlier, it's like, you know, someone must be influencing you. And one of the things available to Amber potentially would be drug use. It's like, well, this must be your drug use. And if he's using more and more over time to cope with the abuse, then it's an easy scapegoat. It's not you, because I need you to be perfect and ideal and a safe place for me to pour all of my hopes and dreams of finally having a secure relationship into. So if you give me any pushback or there's something rejecting about you, it must be the drugs and alcohol. So I could see that.
Even when I was stone cold sober off of alcohol and substances aside from my meds, the term the monster was still there.
I will say that he was prescribed Xanax and psychostimulant for presumably ADHD, I don't know. But with Xanax, if you take it frequently, you can have memory problems. So there's that. I don't know if that's the situation, but that often can happen. Also, if you take Xanax frequently, you can be intoxicated in a way that you don't actually know you're intoxicated. I've taken Xanax and Valium, both benzodiazepine, prescribed by my dentist, actually, because I had this pretty severe, to anyone else, it wouldn't be that big of a deal, but to me, it was a big deal. I would describe it in gory detail, but there was a drill involved for a half an hour into my jawbone, various drill bit size. And, you know, particularly back when I had this procedure like 10 years ago, there's no way I would have been able to deal with that given my anxiety. And my dentist, who also has dental anxiety, said, here's what I do. Take, you know, this amount of Valium the night before and this amount of Valium just before, and you should be okay. And I was okay. I was chilling. And I thought, how am I getting through? Like, I'm totally just chill. But I didn't feel drunk. But my wife was with me and said, you were loopy, you're a little weird, you know? So you can be intoxicated on benzodiazepines. Now, if you're taking it all the time and it's the same pill every day, same time, it's not likely to happen, but it could. And that could affect everything that's being said here. His memory, he could become irritable sometimes if he is low on that substance, because you can become dependent on that substance, and your brain can be affected by when you take the pill, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. There's no data of any of that, but I just wanted to throw that out there. When I hear him on a prescription benzodiazepine, oftentimes what that means is the person is literally taking it every day.
Accused me of being high on cocaine or drinking like I was some kind of 19th century sailor. That was the word she clung to describe, but it was in her mind, not mine.
How did your relationship with Ms. Hurd affect your substance use?
For example, when we were on the road, when you're traveling from, if you're on a press tour, or if you're making a film and you're staying in hotels or this or that, I would always have to get a different, or we would always have to book an extra room that I was able to escape to, so I didn't have to lock myself in another bathroom. It breaks you down. The constant haranguing breaks you down. You know, there's a part of you that says, listen, if I'm going to be accused of this, might as well just do it.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate that would happen. That's one of the things that we work on with people who suffer from addiction is that attitude of, well, if you think of me as a loser and an addict, then fine, I'll be a loser and an addict. And that is one of the coping styles to being verbally abused or criticized or harmed. When we have those chronic experiences, we can either surrender, avoid, or overcompensate. Now, there's a whole other way of dealing with it, which is try to heal from the whole thing, which I guess is a fourth way of dealing with it. But to surrender is to give in. So another example is if you're told that you're a loser and you're incompetent and you'll never amount to anything, one of the ways of coping with, because it gets into your head, the way to cope with that schema is to say, okay, I guess I will just be that. Because one, it feels like, well, I might as well, why try to get out of it? Because, everyone else is convinced I'm a loser, so I might as well be that way. Another motivation is, well, at least I can say that I participated in my own self-destruction. You know, if I did try and fail, then it'll hurt even more. So I'll just say, you know what? Fine. I'm a loser. I'm an addict. And I choose that. But yes, I get it. I'm a loser. But yes, but I also am choosing that. So at least I'm not that much of a loser because I never try, you know. So when people are suffering from addiction and they're being told that they're a loser and an addict, even when they're trying not to use, then that can cause that surrender schema behavior, which is unfortunate. But the other thing that we will work on with people that suffer from addiction that will talk this way is you are just using someone else as an excuse for you for your own use. The addict mind, if you will, is looking for any excuse to capitalize on the situation and get you to use. Just because someone's convinced that you're using or is accusing you of being a drunk or a junkie, then your addict mind just uses that as an excuse because it's always looking for something anyway. So you can't blame your use on someone else. You have to take responsibility yourself. There's a kind of a fuzzy zone there. And certainly if you're being abused and you have no way out, I wouldn't look at a situation like that and say that the drug use is, you know, completely 100% that victim's responsibility. But I just want to throw that out there because I'm sure people in recovery, when they hear something like that being said, depending on what sort of recovery you're in, they would say, oh, Johnny Depp, you're not supposed to say that. Like, you can't blame your use on someone else.
It never exceeded. It never, my substance abuse or use, the alcohol that I used or drank was, again, purely, it's that little boy who didn't want to hear or didn't want to feel the pain of his mother turning him into some kind of ball of insecurity. And
yeah, I believe him. I believe that is the motivation for him to use. People who use substances a lot and are in touch with their trauma will often be very aware that, yeah, I don't drink to have fun. I don't drink to socialize. I drink to numb the voices in my head from when I was a child and I was being told or treated in a certain way. And it works, you know. So there's that. But I also think that he's kind of downplaying his use. I mean, I don't know the details, but I think to me, he would be more convincing overall. I'm not on the jury. If he were to say something along the lines of, well, I do have a problem with substances that is completely independent of Amber Heard. But Amber Heard made it worse in this way. But I don't want to blame all my use on her, and there were times when I overused. The claims that I was abusive during that time is false. Might I have been more aggressive at times? Yeah, but it was rare. You know, I would, if he said something like that, I would think, oh, okay. But we're not hearing any mention of how he would drink because of him, and it was independent of Amber. How, well, I guess he just said that he would because, you know, the insecurity. But he, I don't know, he's not emphasizing it very much. And, you know, maybe he will eventually.
Said the words to me because I wanted to know. I wanted to know. Am I an alcoholic? Am I an alcoholic? Or is this just the same thing that I did as a kid when I took my mom's nerve pill?
Okay, so we actually don't have a clinical definition for alcoholism. You might be surprised by that, but we have definitions in the DSM for substance abuse. People will often talk that way. It's like, am I an alcoholic? Am I not? And I suppose if you map it onto alcohol use disorder, then the main criterion is your use ruining your life or affecting your life negatively? That's a hard thing to evaluate, especially if you're asking the individual to report on the ways in which alcohol is affecting their life negatively. I mean, you could argue that everyone who drinks has been negatively affected by their drinking, right? Now, in the DSM, there are other criteria. Of course, that's not the only criterion. There are several others. But generally speaking, that's the core of it. Because you could, for example, I guess, by definition, drink a lot on the weekend. And from the outside, it might look like alcoholism. But if your life isn't affected by that, then you don't really fit criteria. Now, if you're drinking a lot and it looks like alcoholism, it probably is, because it probably is affecting the individual. At the very least, it's harming their health, right? So, but it's hard to gauge. Now, people who have problems typically will present in very, very similar ways. So I'm not saying that it's ambiguous or hard to detect. When I have someone with a substance use problem or any kind of addiction, it's very easy for me to gauge pretty quickly, actually, as long as they're being honest with me, where they are on a spectrum of compulsive problem. So we're hearing from him that he has heard from multiple chemical dependency treatment professionals telling him that I think he's going to say that even though he drinks a lot, he's not an alcoholic. And that sounds suspect to me. I can't, one, even the rumors that I've heard of him using and of his own, I mean, he has already talked about how throughout his life he has used substances to numb out. That is a classic major criterion for substance use disorder, or for generally speaking, a compulsive chemical dependency. So I don't know where he's going with this, but I think he's about to say something that a lot of people who suffer from addiction will say pre-awareness and pre-recovery, that I've got it all in control. It's fine. There's nothing wrong. Yeah, sure. I drink, you know, and I use several drugs and opiates, and sure, you know, I need benzos to get through the day. Oh yeah, and sure, you know, I need a stimulant to make sure that I wake up, and you know, and I'm not accusing Johnny. The stimulants could be absolutely medically necessary. The benzodiazepine could be medically necessary, but it's not uncommon for people who are suffering from addiction to be in this state of mind, and they believe it because it. If they don't believe this, then they have to face the fact that they have a problem, which means it threatens their use, which is extremely threatening to them. If they can't have that coping mechanism of using, then they feel like they might as well just walk off a cliff at this point, because how in the world are they supposed to survive without that? And of course, he's already said those things, and he's been using substances since he was 11 years old to cope with his emotions. So, you know, to be completely sober might be almost impossible for him. Now, he's claimed that he's gone for periods of time of sobriety, so that could be true, but I don't know. I'm not convinced. And you chemical dependency people out there, I'm sure as you watch this, you're like, Johnny, I don't, like, again, it, as I was saying earlier, it would be much more believable. And he could be telling the truth, and what do I know? But I would much more believe him if he said, yeah, I got a problem. And I can't cope with my emotions without substances. It's a problem. I've gone to a lot of therapy. I've tried. I'm getting better. But I still struggle. And one could argue that my use of other prescription substances, although medically necessary, might be kind of wrapped up in that safety blanket for me that I feel like I need, given my traumas. Yeah, I have a problem, and all that's true. I never abused Amber Heard, you know, like, but I think he's about to say that his therapists have told him that he doesn't have a problem with something. Now, there's a possibility that non-chemical dependency therapists that didn't know what they were talking about either placated him or literally believed that they could evaluate this sort of thing and just said, no, I don't think you have a problem. You know, it's okay to have a drink now and then. What's wrong with that?
Do I have a drinking problem? It essentially came down to this. Do you have a drinking problem, Johnny?
Objection. Calls for hearsay.
How often would Miss Heard drink in your presence while you were in a relationship?
Always. Well, Miss Heard drank she took a shine to a very nice Spanish wine called Vega Sicilia. She and all her friends did. Yeah, the wine would come out, and Miss Heard could very easily drink two bottles of wine per night. Well, not a problem.
Okay, so we're hearing from him that she drank frequently. There were other reports from others saying similar things. The assistant, the others, I can't remember, but he is saying that she could drink a couple bottles of wine in one night, no problem. Yeah, that's a lot of alcohol. If you have a high tolerance, if you don't mind being extremely intoxicated, then that's not uncommon, you know, to happen. Now, is he just saying that and he, you know, it happened once or twice and he's saying it happened, he's implying it happened much more often than it actually did? I don't know. And I will say that people who suffer from severe attachment, threats, and insecurity will often turn to substances to cope in the same way that I think Johnny Depp did.
What I found strange was when I did get sober from the, well, I was off the opiates that I had been addicted to prior to a year or so before, a couple of years before. She asked me if I would stop drinking to save the relationship, of course, and I stopped drinking. I always found it odd that in support of me not drinking, that she might stop drinking. But she did not.
All right, who knows? A little bit of detail, but we're hearing from his account that at some point she asked that he stop drinking to save their relationship. That should tell us something potentially about his drinking. Usually people who are confronted in that way, they usually have at least some level of a problem. And I don't know if he's saying he doesn't have a problem, so I don't want to put words in his mouth, but yeah. And he's saying that he did quit and that he thought Amber would also quit, which is, you know, customary for sure, but not everyone's going to do that. But apparently she did not. Now, she might claim, look, he would drink all day long, all the time, and he was heavily intoxicated, and the demon monster would come out during that time. And I was at my wit's end, and I said, you got to stop drinking. And I pleaded with him several times. He fought with me about it. He finally quit drinking, and he wasn't happy about it, but I was happy to see him not drinking because I thought maybe our relationship would get back on track. And yeah, sure, when my sister had a birthday party, I would drink and come home, and I guess he might have known that I was drinking, or I guess maybe it was a little insensitive to me when my friends came over, we'd be by the pool and we'd have some drinks. I don't know, I just didn't want to ruin my social life, but I guess looking back, maybe it was a bad thing that I did that. Or are we seeing a situation where she's just like, control, I don't care about you? I guess we'll probably never know, but you can make your call about that.
The glass came up to toast. And I just, in my head, I thought, it's just champagne, you know, a little bit tink to toast Christopher and his Lifetime Achievement Award. And so I'd had half a glass of champagne with Christopher Lee and his wife. Immediately after that award ceremony, I went to pick up Miss Heard and take her to dinner at a restaurant. And I told her that I'd had a half a glass of champagne with Christopher, and I thought, listen, it's not like, you know, you're sitting in a pub guzzling pints of snake bites or...
All right, so he's saying that during his 18 months of sobriety from opiates and alcohol, and I was wondering what he meant by that, because he would just say he was sober, but because the main things would be the alcohol and the opiates. And he is saying also that he's currently sober, and I have no reason to disbelieve him, but I don't know. I guess I've been around the block enough times to know that people with addictions will lie or lie to themselves or minimize or leave stuff out. And, you know, I'm not judging him. I'm not shaming him, of course, but I just have to say what's going on in my mind. I'm just like, well, I don't know. Or he's in court. He's just trying to portray a certain way. But anyway, he's talking about a story that when he was still with Amber, that he went to an event giving Christopher Lee a, you know, Saruman, right? Christopher Lee, isn't he Saruman? And many other roles, obviously. And that there was a ceremony that he presented the award for Christopher Lee, and there was champagne and toasting, and he felt like, well, it'd be weird if I didn't drink a little bit of this, so he drank a little bit of it, just a half glass of champagne. And if it's a regular champagne glass, like, you know, it's not that much alcohol by content. But now, if I were his sponsor, I would say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, right? Like, it's a slippery slope. It's not a guarantee, but, you know, once that alcohol, even a little bit like that, hits the brain or the door is ajar a little bit, it's going to be hard to close that door back up again. So you could have just not drank it. You could have said that you didn't feel well, or you could have literally said, I'm a recovering alcoholic. That's the best thing you should do, because that's the best thing to protect you from these kinds of events. And just say, sorry, can't drink, recovering alcoholic, I'll toast, but, you know, sorry, can't drink, but congratulations, and, you know, whatever. But he's claiming that it wasn't a big deal, and he goes back to Amber and discloses that, and he's like, it's not a big deal to her, and apparently she reacted.
Guinness were doing shots of Jägermeister, or at that point it wasn't even for need to bury feelings or emotions. It was literally a joyous occasion for Christopher, and I said to her, I enjoyed it, you know. It gave me the opportunity to enjoy the actual champagne, the drink, and my appreciation for wine and winemaking, and that I've been fascinated with for years and years. And I saw nothing wrong in it, and I said, I'd like to have a glass of champagne. And she was sitting there with a glass of wine.
Well, I didn't know it was headed there, so I don't know. But if he does have a problem with substances, and you were married to him, and you saw the downside of his use to his body, to his mood, to his work, to his productivity, to him embarrassing himself, all sorts of problems, and you fight for him to realize that he has a problem, for him to get sober, he finally gets sober, but he's not really invested in recovery. There's a situation where you could argue he could have said, I can't drink this, or he could have just put it up to his lips and put it back, but he decided to take a little bit of that drink. I don't know, but if you were my client, I would assume that was his addict side saying, like, well, you can't turn it down. It would be impolite to do so. It's just a classic slippery slope first move from people who suffer from addiction. It's always these little things. And this is why when you're in full recovery, you announce as soon as you walk into a room, recovered alcoholic here, recovering addict, don't offer me anything. Like, you put it out there, and then it's in the room. You don't hide. You're not ashamed of yourself. And people know to not do that. Or if they do, you'd be like, remember, I just said that. So, you know, you're doing something that I clearly said don't do. And pre-full recovery from addiction, you're not there yet, because there's still that strong addict mind that's like, well, but I, what if, you know? And it knows, you could argue, that if you slam the door shut, then you're never going to be able to use again. So you always want to keep it ajar a little bit. And that's how it gets you. But anyway, so we're hearing that. And I don't know about John. Yeah, I'm not saying anything about him, but if I heard that story in a client, I would go down a road of, and they were asking me help with their addiction, I would really drill down on that and probably confront them on that, because that's what they're asking me to do. If they want me to help them with their recovery, these are those moments. You know, I would literally say something like, look, I'm sorry, but you literally pay me for the goal of helping you to attain sobriety, because that's what you came in for. And I just have to say, you did something that really threatens your sobriety, one, just by having that little bit of champagne. Now, I'm not going to say that I'm an abstinence-only person. There are people who can certainly use in moderation and have it not be that much of a problem. But I am hearing a lot of things from Johnny Depp himself that are a lot of red flags of someone who probably needs to be completely sober in order for his life to be manageable. Anyway, so then he meets up with Amber Heard after having that half glass of champagne, and he is like, look, it's not a big deal. I actually enjoyed, and I again, I don't know about Johnny, but I will hear people that suffer from addiction, they'll say like, hey, you know what? I just had half a glass of champagne and I'm okay. My life isn't falling apart. Everything's fine. You know, maybe champagne, you know, because champagne, you know, you could see someone think this, because normally I drink wine, which, you know, you just tend to guzzle wine. This is the way they think. And then with champagne, though, you enjoy, you know, you sip it. You know, you're not going to guzzle a bunch of champagne. Of course, some people do. But you could see someone, an addict voice saying, look, it's just champagne. Maybe that's the answer. You can have the alcohol. You're not going to you've never binged on champagne. You don't know anyone who's binged on champagne. It'll be fine. It's totally different, even though it's not any different. It's the same molecule that enters the brain. So then he goes to Amber and says, look, I'm going to have a glass of champagne because I think I'm ready, that kind of thing. And if I'm reading the situation right, Amber Heard's like, oh, no. You have a big problem with alcohol. We're not going back there. Don't do this to me. You know, no, this is bad. I know you when you get drunk. That's one way of looking at it. Another way is, I'm a controlling person and I'm distorted about you and everything about you, including your drinking. And so I'm going to freak out over nothing. I don't know. You make the call.
And we were in the restaurant and she absolutely lost it and got up and stormed to the ladies' room. And I told my security and driver, I said, I think we have to go.
Now, I will say that if you're ever in that situation, the way I was describing it, I don't know if it's accurate to this, but if you have a partner or a family member who suffers from addiction and you work really, really hard to help them to get sober, and then they show up one day, think, you know, out of the blue, they're like, I think I'm ready to drink. And you're like, what? How do you possibly think that you're okay to drink given all that we've been through with your drinking? The way to respond, there's a lot of ways to respond. To get livid and walk away is one reaction, but there are many others. Now, it's possible that he's leaving stuff out. Like she said nicely, like, hey, no, why? Don't, please. And he was like, you're trying to control me. And then, you know, back and forth. She's like, well, I'm not going to be here if you're going to drink, so I'm out of here. You know, who knows? But the way to communicate, because often recovery depends on how the support system and particularly the spouse reacts to relapse. And it's not your fault as a partner, of course, but you are a major factor in helping them. And one of the ways to respond would be, well, look, and this is what I would do if I were in that situation. I would say, if you want to drink a glass of champagne, that's up to you. I'm not your mom, but I will say that when I hear that, it terrifies me because I know what it was like before. And I know that you think it's not going to be a problem, but you know, your sponsor, I don't think he has a sponsor. But what I've understood about substance use is that it can get out of control, and maybe it won't for you, but I have to say it terrifies me. And I will say I'm kind of hurt because we've talked a lot about how your drinking affected me. And for you to consider drinking, I know you don't mean it this way, but it hurts my feelings because it feels like you're willing to take a chance on returning to the way things were before. And I'm also worried because you're not in a 12-step program. You're not going every day to AA. You're not doing the work, and that's up to you, but I'm worried about myself. I'm worried about what you do when you are drunk, or how distant you get, or how volatile you get, or how much I feel bad for you because you're so intoxicated sometimes. And so That would be that. And then inside, and then, you know, the other person does what they want with it. You can have a conversation, but then you yourself have to draw boundaries. And maybe that's what Amber did. Maybe she's just like, fine, if you're going to drink, I can't be around you. And that's sometimes what is best.
I leave. So we left the restaurant and went home. And the mere suggestion of me sipping a glass of champagne or having one glass or two glasses of wine, she went apoplectic. I was weak. I was a complete mess. I was an alcoholic. I was going to ruin everything. Your kids are not proud of you. They can't stand what you're doing.
Yeah. So that would be consistent with Johnny Depp's claim of her verbal abuse. And I guess I should include this because it looks like there's a possibility this was happening, that when you suffer from borderline, you can have an additional aspect to it of codependency, which means that you feel safest when you are taking care of someone with a problem, and you need that person to have a problem in order to help them. If that person doesn't have a problem, then you can't engage in that constant activity of saving someone from themselves. I'm not hearing that. I'm not hearing codependency, so let's get off that track. But there's also another, you know, way in which people with borderline will mesh well with someone with a substance abuse problem, because the person with, there's so many different aspects to how these two fit together. The person with borderline will subconsciously prefer someone with a substance abuse problem because that person needs an enabler. They need someone to pick up around them, and that makes the borderline person feel more secure in this kind of pathological way, because it's like, well, they can't really function without me. And also, if I have deep amount of hurt that I'm not aware of, that I transform into anger and verbal abuse, it's very easy for me to abuse someone with substances because they have a problem that they're already ashamed of and don't have a way of really fighting back. So I can berate them and berate them and berate them, which causes them, this is all subconscious, which causes them to use more and use more and use more, which causes me to have more, you know, ammunition to berate, 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 because I have so much anger because I have so much hurt that needs to come out. So there's a possibility that's what we're seeing. And again, I don't blame anyone in Amber Heard's position for having a major meltdown, so to speak, when you've been fighting for so long to get your partner sober. They've been sober for 18 months. You've had some reprieve from the past, and then they show up at dinner and they're like, I think I'm going to start drinking again. And they don't even recognize what they're asking and what they're saying. That'd be normal to have some level of meltdown, but to berate and to put down and to say he's a terrible father, like, yeesh.
So at that point, I said to her, okay, listen, how about this? You want to support me not drinking? I've never asked you this before. How about you stop drinking? How about you get sobriety and share this sobriety with me?
Totally fine. But again, when I have treated people with this disorder, they will sometimes have these stipulations. Well, I'm not stopping drinking if my partner's not going to stop drinking, because, you know, that's unfair. And I'll be like, nope, that's not how this works. Your partner might have a problem too. I don't know. But that's for them to figure out, and that's for them to deal with on their own. And you can certainly have a chat with that. But your sobriety and your use is yours. And having any other perspective is the addict mind allowing you to continue to use. Always having a stipulation, always having a way out of sobriety so that you can get into using again. And I wouldn't word it like that, of course, but, you know, that would be the kind of gist. And yeah. Now, again, it's totally normal if you are going through recovery to ask your community, can you not drink around me? Or best, could you just not drink at all? Like, could we all just stop? Because it'll help. You can ask for sure. And maybe if people refuse, you might have to draw some boundaries with them, maybe even cut them out of your life, depending on your level of difficulty getting sober, for sure. But to say, okay, fine, I'll stop if you stop, but if you don't stop, I'm going to drink. If Amber Heard sees herself as not having a problem or not as much of a problem as him, then she could be rational in saying, well, I don't, you're just kind of pinning this on me. I don't have a problem with drinking. I drink, but I don't have a problem with it. You're the one with the problem. Now, I will say, if you ever have a partner that is going through recovery and they ask you, you know, you should heavily consider also quitting for sure. And if you can't, you know, you should probably go through recovery yourself. Just because you're not as bad as your partner doesn't mean you also don't have a problem.
Support me and help me through this.
What did she say to that?
No. No. She said no. She said she didn't have a problem. But I've never had a physical addiction to alcohol. I don't.
How often have you seen Ms. Heard use other...
So he says, I've never had a physical addiction to alcohol. And this is an old way of thinking that I don't know if he possesses, but I'll just point it out that we used to think, even in our field to a large extent, that if you didn't have withdrawal symptoms, then you weren't really dependent. It was this medical model dealing with addiction. This idea that for some people who drink, they'll binge drink or they'll drink to cope. And their drinking might be sporadic. They might go for a month without drinking, but then they have like a week of binge drinking. Or they'll go for, you know, 2 weeks without drinking, but then they'll have like a Friday night where they just become completely out of control drunk. Or they only drink every 3 days and it's just two glasses of wine because they're stressed out. And they don't experience any withdrawal symptoms in between use. They could stop for a month. They don't feel that physical withdrawal symptoms that people will get when they drink chronically or use opiates chronically and suddenly stop or use less. So a lot of people, again, who are in the throes of an addiction will say this sort of thing to me. They're like, well, I'm not an addict because I can quit at any time. I can drink. I don't have to drink. I went for a couple weeks. I didn't drink. I didn't have a craving and it was fine. It might be true, but often what we find is there's an overall pattern of compulsivity using to cope without any other way of coping. They are oriented towards alcohol. For a lot of people that don't go down a road of addiction, when they drink, it's circumstantial. It's just like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess I'll have a drink. You know, it's not on their mind. It's not something that they are oriented towards. People with substance abuse problems, even when they're not using, they're oriented toward that thing because their mind, body, and soul, or mind, body, or soul, needs that thing so much. You know, it's a compulsive itch, and there's a lot of thought that goes into it.
She was always quite fond of MDMA, which is ecstasy, and mushrooms. She had some medications that she was on already that were, well, one in particular was quite a high velocity. Speed, if you will.
Okay, so we're hearing from Johnny Depp that Amber Heard would use ecstasy and mushrooms and a stimulant. Okay.
I don't know if I can say the name. Am I allowed to say the name? It doesn't matter.
That's not necessary. How often did you see Ms. Heard take MDMA?
I wonder what name, was it crack? Because I'm trying to think of a stimulant that he would be shy about naming. Do you have a guess as to what he was? I mean, who knows? It doesn't really matter, but I'm curious as to what he was referring to.
It didn't happen. I've never struck Miss Heard. As I said yesterday, I've never struck Miss Heard. I've never struck a woman in my life. I'm certainly not going to strike a woman if she decides to make fun of a tattoo that I have on my body. That's like going into someone's journal and picking out things you don't like. She had made mention... there was no incident of argument when the tattoo thing had been brought up many, many times, and I mean, there's really nothing I can do. I've always thought of my body as a journal, if you will, to mark.
I wonder if they're referring to, because I know enough about Johnny Depp that he had a Winona tattoo in the 80s, did he not? Because him and Winona Ryder were a thing back in the day. I think that's what we're talking about right now, that he has these tattoos that he got in reference to his current partner. And if you have borderline, or even if you don't, you could imagine someone having a concern about that. If you look at their body and it's like, there's your ex's name on here. For those of you who watch 90 Day Fiancé with me, you know, Jasmine was triggered by paint that Gino had in his apartment or house or whatever. So you've imagined that the ex's name is right on someone's body. You know, you can imagine that. But if you're borderline, it's going to be particularly hurtful and threatening and scary. But I feel like I remember that after he broke up with Winona, he like tattooed over it with something. I don't know. I don't know what they're talking about, but I'm guessing it was something along those lines. And Amber claims that as she was criticizing him, he became violent with her. And he's saying that he was never violent with her.
Experiences, historic life experiences, is it, you know, for example, when you're...
Okay, actually, I thought I'd look it up because I am genuinely curious about this tattoo. And right, he had a Winona forever, and then he had it changed to Wino forever, meaning someone who drinks wine. He had slapped Miss Heard 3 times after she laughed at his Wino forever tattoo when he was drinking heavily. So I guess that's what they're talking about. Now, if he was drinking heavily, like heavily, blackout, brownout heavily, then one, he wouldn't necessarily remember what he did. Two, you're capable of doing things under extreme intoxication that you would never do otherwise. So are we looking at a situation like that? I don't know. Now, if you're anti-Amber, you could claim, well, she's just saying that because she knew he was drinking and she knew that she could get away with an allegation that he might look bad because he's alcohol, because he's drinking.
No one can go back, or no one should go back and rewrite their journals. Why would I take such great offense to someone making fun of a tattoo on my body? That allegation never made any sense to me whatsoever. What a tattoo that I believe is up here, which used to say Winona Forever, who was a former girlfriend, and we'd been together for a few years. Winona Ryder, and when we broke up, how do you fix that? I did go back and read.
I have to say, as a teen in the 80s, Johnny Depp and Winona Ryder together, as far as I paid attention to some things, I do remember that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't she caught shoplifting, even though she's a millionaire, that kind of thing? And so, you know, I've speculated, and I've treated people who have compulsive stealing behaviors for various different reasons. Some, you know, sometimes it just makes no sense as to why someone would do that. Now, I guess you could argue that since that is a part of me, that my bias could be pro Johnny, because for so many years he was one of our guys. I remember watching 21 Jump Street in high school and you know, thinking that Johnny Depp was the coolest, you know, and he was the center of that show. There was him and his buddy. And then Richard Grieco came on the scene. He was the bad boy. And, you know, and Edward Scissorhands and then his eventual rise in stardom. You know, there's just so many things about his career early on that was a big part to my generation. So, you know, and I have almost no knowledge of Amber Heard. The only thing that I knew about her before reacting to their audio a few years ago was that she was someone with Johnny Depp, and had she been in Aquaman yet by that point? I don't know. That's the only thing I can think of seeing. And if I saw her, I wouldn't make that connection because I didn't like Aquaman, and she was in makeup and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, you have to consider that, right? As a therapist, for example, if they were to come into my office, which would never happen, I would have to really get a lot of consultation, supervision around my very potential bias for Johnny Depp. And I'd have to really monitor that and make sure that I wasn't favoring him or believing him more or something like that.
Rewrite my journal to some degree. I took off the last 2 letters and had it say Wino forever, just because I thought it was, she was very encouraging in me getting a tattoo of her name or whatever. And, I waited a while, and then I did it. I got a full tattoo of her, and it ironically wasn't long after that that everything started going sideways. I was doing anything I could to bring a smile to her face, as opposed to the frown and then the onslaught of whatever problems she was seeing or experiencing.
I don't know if this is accurate, but if she does have borderline and she has that type of borderline that can result in a lot of hostility and seeing problems that don't actually exist, which not every borderline person will manifest their disorder that way, then what Johnny Depp is describing is a common feeling, common account of being with someone like that, that you, and of abuse, right? You're in a constant state of trying to please and trying to entertain and trying to make the other person happy and always worried about around the corner at any time there's going to be some trigger that is going to happen and I'm going to get that frown and then I know what that means. It's going to be, I'm going to be in conflict for the next number of days and I'm going to be attacked. I'm going to have to defend myself. It's going to be awful. That sounds like what he's describing, right?
I was filming a film called Black Mass in Boston, and Miss Hurd had come with me.
Was Miss Hurd staying with you in Boston during the entire time that you were making that film?
Yes. Yes, she was. She was adamant. No, it's not time. It's not time. So, in explaining how these withdrawals start to take over your body, when I was begging at that point for the meds, I found that I had sort of rolled off the couch and I was sitting on the floor crying, tears streaming down my face, begging another human being to please give me the meds that will take this away.
All right, so I haven't been reacting much because there wasn't much to say other than just to listen to Johnny Depp, but he's talking about how he was in the throes of a pretty heavy opiate addiction on pills, the Roxycodone, and he is talking about trying to kick the habit, trying to abstain, and typically, almost always, you have to go through a detox period in which you prepare for the onset of withdrawal symptoms, which are really quite intense. You need medical care during that time. You can, like I said in a previous video, you can have serious complications from the withdrawal. And while I'm on the topic, I mean, I'm not a medical provider, but I know enough about it to say that whenever you change medications, you should always consult with your physician, because for some medications, there can be really serious effects to coming off the substance. You know, people just say, well, you know, I don't think I need it anymore, and they just stop taking it. And, you know, some pretty serious things can happen, even fatalities. So he is saying that he wanted to go to his private island to detox because he didn't want to be around paparazzi or anything. He was planning on going down there and he didn't want Amber to come because he knew that it was going to be a very difficult time for him. It wasn't going to be a vacation. It was going to be kind of gnarly down there. And so he was saying to Amber, you shouldn't come. But Amber Heard insisted. He basically was saying that he didn't have any choice but to let her come. And so she did. And then they're in the island, they're on the island, and he's detoxing, and he is going through various different waves of withdrawal symptoms, and he is asking for the medication that helps him get through the withdrawal symptoms. I'm not really quite sure what meds he's talking about. Often what we are talking about, I'm not a super expert on it. There was a time when I knew all this stuff because I actually used to treat people with this. I didn't prescribe these, you know, these medical assistance to withdrawal symptoms. But, you know, I remember in my doctorate learning about antagonists and other kinds of things. And I'm forgetting all that stuff. It's not part of my regular practice these days. But there are medications you could take that can replace the activity of the opiate in the nervous system, but won't get you high and will give you a chance to, it's like an in-between drug. You know, when you're taking the opiate, you're seeking to be sober from that completely without the drug, there's a set of in-between drugs. I'll just say that's probably what I should have said in the beginning. And I think that's probably what he's talking about. Now, he's saying that normally he would have had someone else there that would have helped him with this process. And I think he's implying that because Amber Heard is there and because Amber Heard is controlling or mean or something, when he asked for the drug, he wasn't getting it from Amber because Amber was refusing to give it to him. Whereas if it was his original choice to come with him to the island, they would have given him the medication. Okay. Now, I don't know, but it could be, if we look on the positive side for Amber Heard, it's possible that she was instructed to only give him this in between medication or this assistance medication in, you know, a certain regimen and not to take it too much at one time. There could have been, I don't know, there could have been complications, or it could just delay the inevitable, because as you detox, there's likely going to be some withdrawal symptoms. And if you take that medication every time you feel even slight discomfort, then it's just prolonging the inevitable that you have to go through. So, and again, I don't know if any of this is true, but I can imagine that being true. And Amber Heard said to him, he recalls that she said, it's not time yet. So that implies to me that she was instructed by someone else to follow a certain time schedule for Johnny Depp's benefit. And I'm guessing that Amber Heard, being his wife, wanted him to be sober from that and was kind of caught in a bind there. And that, but for Johnny Depp, according to him, and we could imagine, right, that in the moment, one of two things could be happening. One is he's like, you don't understand, like a huge wave is happening right now. And I don't care if this delays it a little bit. I need the med now. You don't understand how horrible this feels. Cause you know, he went into detail about how it feels. And yeah, it sounds like classic opiate withdrawal symptoms, which is just truly awful, which is a big reason why people get addicted and a big reason why y'all should be extremely careful whenever you take these meds. And as soon as you feel that urge or that itch to take them past the prescription or when you don't really need it, it should be a huge red flag of, oh, This is the beginning, you know, because if you catch it in the beginning, it's much easier to kick the habit than it is once you're at this point. So that's one option, is like if the physician were there, they would recognize, oh, well, he's having a particular episode right now. So let's go ahead and administer this medication prior to the time schedule, because we don't want him to suffer that much. Plus, there can be complications from withdrawal symptoms. So that's one option. The other option is that he was just having a freak out that you have when you go through withdrawal symptoms. Like to detox from opiates, it's sort of no pain, no gain. You can't get through it typically without a fair amount of discomfort. And that's why it's so hard to kick. Even when you have all the resources, for a lot of people, it's so overwhelming. Because, you know, there's the physical pain, there's the nausea, but it's also like this mental experience of horribleness. I don't know I've never been through it myself, but I've been with people and I've heard them describe it. That could be like even 90%. Because if it was just physical, then I think they would be able to cope with it. But it also like just consumes your entire soul and spirit. And so I wonder if there's a logical explanation or understandable explanation as to why Amber Heard would have resisted giving him the medication. But if we don't give Amber Heard the benefit of the doubt, then is this another example of her punishing him and controlling him? I would say that given the profile we've heard thus far, this doesn't fit. That conceptualization of cruelty for cruelty's sake doesn't really fit with what we've seen so far. But then getting back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of her insisting that she come with him to the island, if she didn't have borderline, then she might actually be able to tolerate that, right? She might, even though she's like, well, I want to be there for you. And then Johnny Depp would say, no, I don't want you there, really, because it's going to be awful. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't want to have to worry about you. I don't want you to see me go through that. Look, I'll just go. I'll come back sober. And please just let me do this on my own. Then someone without borderline would, I'm imagining, would say, well, that makes me sad, but totally, if this will be better for you, then please go. But if you have borderline, then everything else is eclipsed by your desperation not to be abandoned. And to have him go to the island would feel emotionally like an abandonment, and so you will insist on coming. I don't know if that's the reason, though.
We went back to Los Angeles, and then I asked Ms. Heard if she would please allow me 5 days, 7 days, whatever it took, to get done with the rest of this horrific detox and the pain.
Did Miss Heard give you that time?
She did, reluctantly, yes. I was
Okay, so he's saying that because of that event and how hard it was, he decided to leave the island, come back to Los Angeles, I believe, and he asked her, okay, I don't want you there, so please give me 7 days away from you. I will get clean, and please let me do that. And she reluctantly allowed him.
I was immediately accused of throwing her out. I was accused of abandoning her.
Right. I mean, just imagine that. Regardless of whether or not she suffers from a personality disorder or not, you are at, and he described this earlier, the lowest point of your entire life. You are in a serious medical and psychological situation, and you're just asking your partner, can you please just leave me alone for 7 days so I can get clean? You know, it's not like he's going on a bachelor party and partying all the time and asking her to stay home. He's saying, I'm going through a massive medical treatment, you know, regimen, and I just don't want you there. Is that okay? And then to have them, instead of your partner saying, totally get it, whatever you need, I'm here for you. If you want me there, I'll be there. If you don't want me there, I won't be, you know, like, that's I think what normal people would do. But according to Johnny Depp, who knows if it's true, he's saying that she became up in arms and accused him of abandoning her and of being a bad person or a bad partner or something. And of course, if you have severe borderline, then that's how it's going to feel like, even though rationally there's nothing about that even closely resembles abandonment, right? And of course, there's some narcissism there of, well, but I don't want to feel abandoned. So that is the only thing that matters. I don't care about your feelings. I don't care about your detox. I don't care about how you feel as you go through the worst part of your life. It's all about me. And people will say people with borderline have narcissism, but it's not the same thing as narcissistic personality disorder. It is because the individual is just so in pain that they can't think of anything else. It's unfortunate that Johnny Depp had to deal with that as a complication during his recovery.
I was accused of not appreciating all that she had done to get me to this point where I was, which was kind of an interesting argument for me.
Yeah. Now, there's a possibility, because as a couple therapist, I am frequently hearing different sides of the story and have learned over time that when I'm hearing one person's side of the story, particularly as they're in a situation like this where they're in court or going through divorce, that I always have to fill in possible gaps of information to derive hypotheses as to why all that would happen. So I've been doing that for Amber thus far. I have no data to back that up, but I'm just throwing that out there as at least the way that I think. And another possibility is that Amber Heard had observed that the way that Johnny Depp's medical team and, you know, psychological team reacted to Johnny Depp was not necessarily always in Johnny Depp's best interest. I don't know. There's no reason to believe that. But I'm just throwing this out there as a possibility that Amber Heard, at least from her perspective, might have seen her, you know, Johnny Depp's medical team pulling punches, if you will, going easy on him because he has so much money and it's so lucrative to work with him that they're not pushing him enough to actually go through the recovery process. And Amber Heard felt like she had to be there to make sure that everyone actually kept on him, because we really want him to be sober and we don't want you worried about him being upset at you, because, you know, we've got to push him because we got to get through this. You know, I don't know, but I could see that happening. I have no data to suggest it happened here, though.
It was very necessary. So she did eventually leave for about five days or so. And I sat in after a few days, I sat in a metal chair with one song on a loop that I could focus on the lyrics and the power of the song to help me get through it. And even once
Well, now I'm curious what song that was. Let me Google it. Maybe someone has disclosed it. Well, the internet is of no help there.
the effects, you know, started to go away. That is the pain. I was still in this. Something strange that happens. you feel electricity in your body. You feel this electric, very foreign, and you're just sitting there like going through it.
Okay, so you just rattled off a bunch of meds. I believe the meds might have been prescribed to help him get through the detox process, medications to suppress the possibility of seizure. He also mentioned lithium, which is typically prescribed for bipolar, not always.
One of his lawyers, sit down with Ms. Hurd and give her a basic rundown of what a postnuptial agreement meant, I was told that they showed
objection,
her...
Objection, hearsay.
What did Ms. Hurd tell you she was upset about when she arrived in Australia?
Ms. Hurd told me that the attorney that she met with was rude and dismissive. All she was being shown was an example of a postnuptial agreement. Ms. Hurd then stated to me that she was very upset. She stated to me that what she had said was, she said to the lawyer, the woman, that this Johnny can't, he doesn't know about this. He doesn't know that this is what this is. No way he would agree to this.
Okay, lots to say. They have been talking for a long time about various different things that I haven't really been reacting to, but they asked Johnny Depp if he wanted to get a prenuptial agreement, and Johnny Depp said, yeah, I brought it up a number of times, but every time Amber Heard would either avoid the topic or she would get combative with him. And given the profile that the Johnny Depp team is proposing for Amber Heard, it would totally fit in line with that. In terms of someone being borderline, the idea of a prenuptial agreement suggests, and it's true, that the person you're marrying isn't 100% in. I mean, well, it's hard to phrase, because there's different ways of looking at it, right? On one level, when you're getting a prenup, people will say, no, I'm 100% in, but God knows how we're going to feel in 25 years. And, I just want to have things legally kind of laid out because I don't want to have to go into a battle in 25 years. I just want to, let's just set it now and while we still like each other. And if something gets weird, we can rely on this so we don't have to go through a big fight. And there are other reasons why people get prenups. Some people get prenups because they want to feel like their partner isn't in it for the money, they're in it for them. There's various different reasons. And I have to say that it's not really in my world. I don't see a lot of people getting prenups or talking about prenups. I'm sure it's something for extremely rich individuals. I don't know. So Johnny Depp has been talking about how he was talking about getting a prenup and that Amber Heard would refuse it. So there are a number of possibilities as to why someone would refuse. One is if you have borderline, then like I said, the suggestion is there that an abandonment might be around the corner. Just imagining. So let me contrast between someone without borderline versus someone who would have borderline. So if you didn't have borderline and you didn't have a similar attachment reactivity pattern, then when you're presented with a prenup from your partner, there's probably going to be a little twinge of fear there and hurt of, oh, really? Like, one, in your mind, it's still possible that we're going to break up, even though we're getting married and saying we're going to be together for the rest of our life. There's a little bit of fear, a little bit of hurt there. Maybe not a little bit, but something. And also some hurt around, so you think that you have to protect your assets from me as if you think that I might have to, that I'm motivated possibly to take everything away from you, even if we did get divorced, because that's not really how I am. So, someone without borderline would have a little bit of pain there. And maybe there'd be some anger or some hurt feelings, maybe some tears, maybe some resistance. But I don't know the typical path emotionally for people, because I don't really see it very often. But I could imagine someone navigating that pretty well. In the end, it's just like, well, so are you saying you want to get divorced? No. The person asking for their prenup would say, no, I'm 100% in. I don't see any reason why we would need this, but my lawyers are telling me I should probably have it. And I don't know, maybe it'll help. I don't know. But I just think it would be good for both of us, just in case, that kind of thing. So they have a conversation, and then the non-borderline individual eventually signs, and they put it behind them, and they check in with the relationship. Maybe there's a little bit of a dip in trust, but then over time, it's rebuilt within time. But if you have borderline, of course, you have this tremendous hurt and tremendous fear because of your relational traumas, and your feelings convince you that it's 80%, 90% sure that's what is happening right now is I am being abandoned. I'm being divorced. I'm being told that I'm a terrible person. I'm being rejected right now because of the feeling and the distortion. And so if you felt that way, you can imagine resisting quite greatly because you want to fight for the relationship, right? Okay. Then Johnny Depp says he resigned and said, well, I guess we're never going to get a prenup. And then after they got married, on the way down to Australia to film Pirates 5, I have to say, I feel like I've only seen Pirates 1. Or maybe I saw the one where they had the bad guy with the octopus thing. But I'm reading between the lines pretty heavily here. But I think what Johnny Depp is telling us is that because they're mounting conflict, he was predicting a strong possibility of divorce, if not very strong possibility, but to some degree. And he's like, well, but we have to get a post up now, because if we get divorced, she's going to take half of everything, and that's not fair to me. Now, that's a whole other topic that we could talk about that involves the history of our legal system, the history of misogyny and sexism and power, and we could debate that. But aside from that, it sounds like Johnny Depp was afraid to bring it up with Amber, or had tried to and it didn't go well. And then he sent one of his lawyers that approached Amber Heard without Johnny Depp telling Amber Heard that that was going to happen. That's what it sounds like. And then the lawyer comes to Amber Heard and says, so this is a postnup. Here's an example. I think we should actually work one out for you and Johnny. And then Amber Heard comes to Johnny Depp on the way to Australia and is very upset about that, and is, according to Johnny Depp, saying that I got, this lawyer started talking about a postnup, and I know that you would never do that to me because that's totally not how I see how our relationship is going. So you could imagine for Amber Heard, if she has borderline and histrionic, that the postnup was proposed. She plummets in terms of her pain, just tremendous pain and anxiety, because just imagine just a rando lawyer starts talking about it. I think most people in that situation, regardless of personality disorder or not, would interpret that as this is the beginning of the end. And if you have borderline, then that's a very, very hard thing to handle, obviously. And so you could go into complete denial, like, this isn't happening. What are you talking about? And then panic and then anger. And then you go to Johnny, like, what was that about? So I think that's what Johnny Depp is telling us.
And what Ms. Heard then expressed to me was that the lawyer, the woman, had laughed at her and said, oh, he knows. Yes, he knows everything. Which sent her into a tailspin.
Right. We could imagine someone saying that to Amber, particularly if Amber was being dismissive or hostile with the lawyer. I don't know. And we could imagine that would be absolutely triggering to anyone, particularly someone with borderline.
So by the time she arrived in Australia, that was sunk very deep into her psyche. So much so that what really surprised me was that she kept saying, I'm not even in your will. I'm not even in your will.
Yeah. Now, of course, a lot of people interpret this as Amber Heard is a gold digger, that she's only in it for his money. And that's what this shows. And certainly that might be true, but that's not how I'm interpreting it at this point, given all the data that we've been presented. I think it has very little to do with money. Of course, anyone likes a lot of money, but so I'm not saying that she wasn't into money or didn't consider that as a factor, but I'm guessing that it had much more to do with trauma being triggered. I mean, just imagine that a lawyer comes out of the blue and says, I'd like to talk with you. And you're like, about what? And they're like, well, it's a post-up with your spouse. I mean, just imagine you now that in, you know, without any warning from your spouse, this rando person comes and says, oh, believe me, he knows about this postnup. So we probably should get this, you know, out of the way. That would be, wait, so what is going on behind my back? Like, if this is going on behind, what else is going on behind my back? And if this is the sort of thing that's going on behind my back, my God, and to someone with borderline, oh boy, that would be one of the biggest triggers you could ever have. You know, not only abandonment indication, but secret conversations behind the scenes about abandonment of you and the humiliation, right? And especially if you've had traumas that were emulative of that when you were young, which can happen. Like, you overhear your parents talking about how terrible you are or something. That can be extremely destructive, right?
I thought that was an odd thing to say, especially since I don't think anybody had had time to change wills or anything of that nature. Those things just didn't... It felt wrong, and she could not let go of the fact that...
And again, whoever is chewing gum into the microphone, I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. I'm like, close your mouth. Because I'm pretty sure if that's someone chewing gum, because it's very irregular, and I think someone is, you know, chew. Because I can't think of anything else as to what it would be. It could be like an electrical anomaly of some sort. I don't know. And if it is, okay. But if it's someone chewing their gum, close your mouth. Chew gum. Go for it. Close your mouth. There are a percentage of people who are very much triggered by hearing your mouth sounds. So if you could give me a time machine, I wouldn't go back and kill Hitler. I would go back to this courtroom and say, I would yell, whoever is chewing gum, close your mouth and move away from the microphone.
In on this post-nup agreement, and that I was trying to trick her into essentially getting nothing if something were to happen.
And how did you respond to Miss Hurd?
So I just told her those were not my intentions. And at a certain point, you don't know what to do. I mean, the person is telling you, she's telling you, you don't trust me, you don't trust me, you don't trust me. And I can't speak about legal documents. I can't speak legalese. I can't explain to her these things. All I could do.
I'm interpreting that Johnny Depp was not being straightforward or direct to Amber, perhaps because of his personality, perhaps also because he's been an ongoing victim of abuse and is trying to stay out of trouble. But it sounds to me like she was doing what I would predict someone with borderline to do, which is being extremely triggered, like, you don't trust me, I don't understand what's happening, how come this is, what's going on in your mind, how dare you, I'm not even in your will, you know, all these indications, like, wait, you want a postnup, I'm not in your will, you're talking to lawyers behind my back, what's happening right now, and then that's what it feels like on the inside, and then on the outside, it's anger and yelling at someone, and Johnny Depp is saying that what he was saying to her was, I'm not a lawyer, I don't understand these things, and it's like, well, everyone understands the topic sentence of what a post, that's why you asked for it. Because in the event of a split, you don't want her to take everything. That's probably why you wanted the postnup, right? Or you could argue that he wanted a postnup because he didn't want there to be a nasty court divorce. He wanted there to be a pre-established agreement, which can be another benefit. I mean, who knows, but he could have literally said, I want a postnup that says you get half and I get half, so that we don't have to go through a court battle, and we'll just do that. You know, like, who knows? I doubt that was the case. But and then when he sent the lawyer and didn't warn Amber, it's another massively passive thing to do, right? So I'm guessing it had both to do with his passive personality, his non-confrontational, typically non-confrontational personality, and his ongoing victim status, if we believe the Amber Heard's or the Johnny Depp side, then he would be terrified of actually confronting her, which isn't, If I were his friend, I would have, prior to this plan of his, I would say, well, how do you think this is going to go? Do you think the lawyer coming out of the blue is going to work? Do you think Amber Heard's going to be like, oh, okay, fine. I mean, she's resisted the idea of a prenup before, and you guys are fighting even more now. So I don't think this is going to work. I think you have to go to couple therapy, more than 4 sessions, and maybe talk about it there. I mean, that I think you need that venue to talk about anything, let alone something as sensitive as that.
Do was try to calm her down and say that I was not out to screw her over or put her in a position.
Another possibility is that it was him being passive aggressive. He was expressing hostility through hidden means. He had a lot of anger towards her, but was afraid, given his personality or given his relationship with Amber, that to directly communicate that, and instead used a very hidden method by going behind her back, talking to someone about a postnup. They refer a lawyer. He talks to the lawyer. The lawyer goes after her, because I have a hard time believing that he thought that was going to go well. I have a hard time believing that he wasn't aware that that would bother her. So why would you do that? Well, it's possible that you wanted to be hostile. You wanted to communicate anger and displeasure, but you felt you couldn't do it directly.
Position that was uncomfortable.
Did that work?
These were stock, normal things to do. It did not work, no. It escalated and escalated and turned into madness, chaos, violence.
Can you please describe that chaos and violence?
Yes, she was irate. She was irate, and she was possessed. And when I tried to remove myself as I normally would from a situation, and that is to say, you know, as she's hammering me with this sort of brutal words, and I don't, pardon my language, but I remember that it wasn't nice, sort of being called an ass kisser to lawyers or a pussy.
Yeah, we've heard recordings similar to that, where Amber Heard would be saying similar things, saying you're not a real man, that kind of thing. And it's an interesting tactic, right, to say to someone. He's saying in the moment that she was escalating. Sounds like he was being passive, and that probably wasn't helping. Like, he could have said something like, look, honey, I want to be with you, but our relationship is not going well. And I thought about the possibility that we might break up. I don't want to break up with you at this point, but I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know how things are going to go. And I thought we should probably get a prenup, and I'm sorry that I didn't tell you. I probably should have, but that's the situation. And you know, do I think that someone with borderline would have reacted better to that? I mean, maybe a little bit, but probably not, honestly, because if you have severe borderline and you don't have insight or recovery, then there might not be any chance of not getting hostile in a situation like that, particularly given the Johnny Depp team's portrayal of her reactivity. But she was calling him out on his manhood, calling him a P-word and all these kinds of things as a way of attacking him, expressing her anger, which is actually a hidden expression of her pain and anxiety. It's also potentially an ongoing tactic that she learned from her parents to control someone, beat them down emotionally and physically to get them to succumb to you, and thus you are able to retain the relationship. I think the Johnny Depp team is painting a picture that as Johnny Depp would show indications of possibly wanting to leave the relationship, that's when Amber Heard's control and abuse would increase. And it looks like this would be one of those flashpoints. So I think, interpreting what Johnny Depp is saying, he was being yelled at and he was avoiding, I think, the questions and saying, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know these things. And then it sounds like she started saying that, you know, you're a P word, you're just bowing down to lawyers, because, you know, it's possible Johnny Depp was saying, it wasn't my doing. I don't know. I was just getting advice about a post-nup, and so I thought it'd be a good idea. I don't know. Like, don't yell at me when it's like, well, you probably were the one that initiated it, or at the very least went along with it, right? So you could imagine being the recipient of that, questioning that, but you know, insulting someone's manhood is not the way to express that upsetness. So, yeah, this is one of those, I think this is one of those moments that is brought up frequently in this case. So let's hear more.
That didn't fight for her or stand up for her. I, again, tried to remove myself from the situation, but to no avail. As I literally, the house that they had rented for me in Australia was quite a large place. It was quite, well, I'll just cut to the chase. I think that I ended up locking myself in about at least 9 bedrooms, bathrooms that day, as she was banging on the doors and screaming obscenities and wanting to have a physical altercation.
Yeah, it sounds believable. You can make your own call as to the believability of that and whether or not he's leaving anything out. But it's, you know, it's pretty excessive. It's pretty demonstrative of abuse. We could imagine that being a trigger for someone that is conceptualized the way they're conceptualizing Amber. And just the unrelenting rage and entitlement to the victim, and how all he's just trying to do is get away. And he says he's locked himself in 9 different bathrooms and hotel rooms to get away from her, and she's banging and yelling at him. So, yeah, it's hard to hear that and think that Johnny Depp is lying about these sorts of things. Might have Johnny Depp also been abusive, but I don't know. It sounds believable. But I haven't gotten to Amber Heard's testimony yet, so maybe I'll be convinced otherwise.
There was at one point where I'd stayed in one of the, sitting on a bathroom floor, door locked. She's banging away, screaming, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly she stopped, and I could hear her walk away. I could hear her receding into the distance, if you will. And yes, yes, it became very emotional, because you can't win for losing. There was nothing I could do to make her understand that I had, if that lawyer had in fact done that, and I did call my lawyer at the time, Jake Bloom, and I had him get these people on the phone, and I'm ashamed to say that I had taken, at that point when I was on the phone with him, I had taken Ms. Heard's words to heart, and I laid out a ration I was very upset that she was pushed to that limit, because I believed it. In fact, none of it had happened. So it was all getting too crazy. And again, I had been sober for many, many months from alcohol and substances, aside from the marijuana.
I think some substance abuse treatment professionals would say, well, okay, if you're off opiates and you're off alcohol, which are highly destructive to your life, then that's a win. And smoking marijuana, cannabis, using cannabis is, on the whole, not nearly as destructive as those other two. So, okay, you could even potentially make an argument that he needed it for this or that, because there are medicinal qualities, of course, But other substance abuse professionals would say, that's not sober, Johnny. You're just keeping the door open to those substances. People will laugh that marijuana is a gateway drug, and that was overemphasized in the past. But regardless of what drug it is, whether it's marijuana or anything else, there's evidence to demonstrate that when you're trying to maintain sobriety, if you let a little bit of substance in and you make excuses for that substance, that allows the door of possibility to be open to other substances. Particularly if you're particularly high on something, then your executive function might be compromised, and you might actually be more likely to use in that situation. So for a lot of people, the best course of action is to be completely sober off of everything, potentially even nicotine, caffeine, maybe even really trying to reduce your psychotropic medications that might have intoxicating effects like Xanax. Of course, you'd always want to talk with your treatment team about that plan, but I was wondering when we were hearing him talk about his recovery, if he was saying that he was sober from alcohol and using opiates, or sober from opiates and using alcohol, or sober from both of those and using marijuana. And so we're just getting a little bit more detail. Yeah, I don't know what that means precisely, but that's just a little bit of detail.
And I left the place, the room that I was hiding in, or not hiding, locked myself into, and I went downstairs in the house. There was downstairs in the house. As soon as you walk in the house, you can go upstairs or downstairs. Downstairs, there was a sort of a rec area, pool table and such. And there was a bar. And I was a mess. I was a wreck. I was shaking, and I just didn't understand why all this was happening. So I went behind the bar. I grabbed a bottle of vodka that was there.
Right. So if... it's hard when you're going through recovery to avoid relapsing under that much pressure. But if you were in proper recovery, you would have maybe two or three sponsors that you could call 24/7. You would be going to daily meetings. You'd probably be recommended to not use marijuana because of the reasons I said earlier. And so the way that he's talking about this is extremely common. It's a very common flashpoint for relapse, is when you're in a fight with your partner. And ironically, when people are going through recovery, they might have increasing fights with their partner because everything is thrown off kilter. Your pattern was for so long involved with this substance, and not only were you married to the substance, but your partner was also married to that substance. And now that that substance is out, then you are left facing each other in a sober way, and you, as a recovering addict, don't have a mature, differentiated ability to manage your emotions, and you're more likely to have erratic emotions as you go through recovery just because of physiological reasons and the frustration of not being able to use. So he's describing a very common scenario for relapse, which is, you know, I feel bad for him, but I would feel more confident in his account and his future if he had a robust treatment plan around him. Maybe he does. I haven't heard reference to it, though.
I shot glass and sat at the bar. She was nowhere around. And I poured myself two or three stiff shots of the vodka, first taste of alcohol I'd had in a long time. And then she came down.
I don't know, but working with clients that have a relapse like this, there are various different motivations for it. Perhaps all of them are at play. One is, I can't cope with this emotion right now. It's just too much pain. I have no ability to manage my own emotions other than to use some substance. So this is my only option. Another motivation is, I know this will piss off my partner because I know how my sobriety is so important to them. So if I drink, it will be this passive aggression towards them. Another one is regressing to a previous time in one's life when there was a lot of pain and a lot of drinking. So it just feels like you're kind of back there. Another motivation is the addict mind is saying, well, you deserve it. Look how she's treating you. So, you know, you'll just have some few shots of vodka in this moment because of how horrible what's happening right now. You deserve it. You know, that's another possible. There are others, but those are the things that come to mind in terms of the way he's describing what happened. All right, well, that does it for that episode. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.